Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. I thought today that we might talk a little bit about what the Arab Spring hath wrought. Actually, I started thinking about maybe the burning question most people have on their minds about the Arab Spring is, what is the correct spelling of Gaddafi's name? Is it a Q, a G, or a K? But there I doubt we'll ever find out.
The problem is, there was, unlike the Chinese, who are much more organized, there was never an official way to transliterate Arabic into English. So somebody went on the internet and found over 100 different spellings of Gaddafi's name.
Wow.
So the answer to that question is no.
No.
There is
no. We'll never find out. Well, what we sort of thought we could do today was, and we talked about this back in the spring when the Arab Spring was in its apogee there, that and it was building and growing, that we could talk about it here in the fall and see what had happened and if it was playing out like people thought it would. Let's take Egypt first and talk about what's happening in Egypt, Jim.
Well, Egypt is very typical of what's happening in all the Arab Spring countries. And we actually pointed this out early on. We have some Israeli correspondents who, you know, provide translations of local Arabic, local meaning, you know, Lebanese and Egyptian media. And what was happening in Egypt was what is probably going to happen in all of them, just like happened, you know, 40 years ago, the last round of revolutions, is it's highly probable that another dictator is going to get into power in each of these countries. Now, the Arabs who are, many of the Arabs in the midst of these Arab Spring uprising are well aware of that. You know, it's not like they're just blindly, you know, walking into another cycle like a bunch of circadians or crickets. They are well aware of the fact that history is about to repeat itself. And especially in Egypt, you're seeing increasing violence to try and prevent this. Because what happened in Egypt was, it was over so quickly in Egypt because the army refused to back Mubarak. And that was the end of that. But in return, the army took control of the country temporarily. Where have we heard that before? In order to hold elections. Now, there's been a lot of fighting over, you know, when should elections be, what are the rules about parties, to use party. I mean, there's many different ways you can run the election and allow parties and what have you. But in the meantime, Egypt continues to be a military dictatorship. Even under Mubarak, it was basically a military dictatorship. The problem in Egypt always was, who does the army back? As Mao Zedong, you know, pointed out very adroitly, you know, power comes out of the barrel of a gun. It used to come at the point of the sword, but technology changes everything. And even with technologies like, you know, Facebook and other social media, it still comes down to who's pointing a gun at you and what do they think. Now, the army has a problem in that it's a lot of conscripts and a lot of people who aren't doing very well economically, or even if they are, they have many kinfolk who are not. Egypt never developed that much of a military case, as is the case in many other countries. So it's still up in the air. But the problem is, Egypt has not had a functioning democracy ever. There was a bit of a constitutional monarchy, you know, after World War II. Then Nasser came along, a radical socialist, a national socialist, that's what the Nazis called themselves, and he turned into a proper Nazi. Mubarak, you know, in succession, continued the dictatorship. And a lot of the Egyptians, and this is what the Israelis are telling, are at their wit's end about coming up with any certain solution to cure this vicious cycle. Many Egyptians are despairing of the fact that they seem headed back to another round of military dictatorship, because the only option is a possible religious dictatorship, which, you know, it's a question of which do you like the least. And most people would rather have a military dictatorship than a religious one because they are well aware of what's going on in Iran and Sudan and what happened under the Taliban. So that's where the revolution stands in Egypt.
Austin?
Well, one of the problems that Jim touched on, the centrality of the military in Egypt, it's part of it is definitely engaged in they're engaged in a long-term stalling process, and I believe that's because of the corruption interest of economic interest. I think there are other elements of the military, though, that do see themselves as a bridge to New Egypt, but they're not quite sure how to make that bridge work, in part because of the threat that's posed by the militants, the extremists in the Muslim Brotherhood, and that's another kind of dictatorship, a clerical dictatorship. And you see how we've got empirical evidence on Iran after 32 years of, since Iran's revolution, what a clerical dictatorship brings you. It brings you the same old problems that the other dictatorships did as well. Corruption, economic stagnation, oppression, and violence. How the Constitution, now the Constitution's still up for grabs. We were supposed to have a look at the drafts. I think first time we were supposed to we've seen them were even last May, June. There are every once in a while leaks and the public discussions about the way the Constitution's going to be drafted. There are various quote unquote versions or recommendations that I've seen. I saw one of them show up on an article I read maybe 5-6. 6 weeks ago. That's going to really they've got to get, since that's the way they want to do it, they're going to write the Constitution first, use that as a way to rebuild the political to reconstruct the political system. Since that's what they decided to do, they need to produce it, and it hadn't been produced. I have no idea when it will be. So.
The military, the corruption of the military is a big issue. The military was very much part of the Mubarak, you know, system, you know, the Mubarak corruption system. The military, at least the senior officers, the officer corps in general, but especially the senior guys, basically had their fingers in a lot of businesses. There were a lot of payoffs. There was a big economic incentive to be in the military, especially as an officer. And they see that threatened. Indeed, if there is a real democracy implemented in Egypt, the officer corps in the Egyptian military is in big trouble.
Well, that's what I meant about the stalling. You know, that's portrayed as a conspiracy theory. I don't think it's a theory. I think that's part of what's going on, why it has been slow, so.
Oh, yeah. Well, we've reported on that several times, and that seems to be what the military are doing. They're scrambling around looking for a viable long-term solution, and many military officers apparently believe the only long-term solution is to take control for the good of the country, as the saying goes.
Right. I'm the military, and I'm here to help you.
Exactly. Isn't that what the IRS says?
Anyway. Dan, before you just dismiss it like that, it could be an instrument of modernization. It's just with all the fingers in the pie, as Jim was describing, it is one that would require a real internal shakeup within the military. And I think we've said that, so I'll end it with that.
Okay. Now, the one that's really interesting to me and hasn't been in the news much is what's happening in Tunisia.
Yeah, well, Tunisia had their election, and the largest number of votes, not a majority, went to an Islamic party. But what's happening in Tunisia, which is a small country, is that they are using as their model Turkey. And they feel that a secular Islamic, at least that's what the winning Islamic coalition is positioning themselves as, they say, you know, secular Islamic a party is the way of the future. What do you think, Austin?
Well, you know, that's what I wrote my the Creator Syndicate column about this week. I mean, it's up in the On Point section on strategy page. Ennahda is the name of the Tunisian Islamist party. They call themselves moderate Islamists. Several of their leaders say, hey, we really don't want to change some of the secular nature of Tunisian society. We're interested in pragmatic issues like igniting, rebuilding, recreating the Tunisian economy. They, you know, pay attention to what the revolt was about, the Tunisian Jasmine Revolution. When it broke out, is we want jobs. They raged about the corruption in Ben Ali's regime, and actually, we just to send the listeners back to one of our early Arab Spring discussions when Jim described the way Tunisia's wealthy elites interacted with the regime. They were running a kleptocracy, you know, for the wealthy, a corrupt operation. Well, it sounds like Ennahda heard what the revolution was about, and they said, well, this is what we want to address. And within 48 hours, as the votes were coming in, their senior leaders asked to approach the two largest secular parties. One of them is kind of center-right. The other one is kind of more leftist socialist, and said, look, we want to form a coalition government. We know we didn't get enough votes. We got the most. But what we want is a coalition government that will be the interim government. Then this is the process of where we now go and write a new constitution, and ultimately they're aiming for a parliamentary elections. I think it's early 2013. So what you're seeing in Tunisia is an attempt out of the largest party, which is styled itself as a moderate Islamist party, modeled after the Justice and Development Party in Turkey. Jim mentioned that it says they're trying to use the Turkish Islamist Party as a model. Say, look, we need a what you might call a unified democratic front. Now, it's a quick sidebar on that. The unified democratic front, it was an attempt to do that in Iran after the 79 revolution, and it was broken apart by the extremists. There's a very fine essay dating from January. I actually wrote about it in one of my columns by Abul Hassan Bani Sadr, who was Iran's first president, and it was written for the Tunisian people, and he says you've got to maintain a unified democratic front no matter what your policy differences are across the spectrum. Those of you who really want a democracy have to focus on that, because the extremists are going to try to undermine it. So the gesture, you know, it could be a hollow gesture, Dan. I don't know. But it certainly looks, I'm talking about from Ennahda, the gesture is, we know we need you two secular parties to be part of the solution, because over the long haul, this is the way we see our new democratic political system working. Well, if that's what Ennahda is about, I would say that's really a remarkable development. I would say that's a good sign. I will also say, we've got empirical evidence on this from last Sunday, that was a very peaceful election in Tunisia. Jim was also sketching some of the why Tunisia is unique in some ways, higher education level, smaller country, lots of contacts with France, seeing themselves in some ways as really a Mediterranean nation. That's something that we, I think, only glancingly touched on, but that's really the conceptualization of it. I don't want to sound like I'm I'd rather be a historian than a historicist, but I think we chuckled about the fact that, you know, Tunisia was Carthage. You know, there's a Mediterranean nation, that's for sure. And they're not the Carthaginians, but the Carthage is part of their a part of their legacy, and that's a trading Mediterranean nation, not a quote unquote. We're an Arab country, but we're not just an Arab country. And that has in the way that they discuss about their long term interests is that we want to, you know, participate in the global the global economy. We want to trade. We want the information. We want freedom of exchange of information. And you know, several of their political leaders talk about their orientation towards Europe. What they mean by that is a European Union. They're looking at the not to sever ties with Algeria or Libya or other Arab nations, but to connect with the European Union and the more advanced and developed markets. That's also an echo of Turkey as well. So right now, if we were, you didn't ask us to grade these things, but I would grade the Tunisian election of last Sunday as remarkably encouraging because of they were carried off peacefully. The always central question of when an Islamist party wins a free and solid open election, can they lose one as well? We'll know more about that as Tunisia progresses over the next 2 years. They can win. The deal is the Islamists win the one election, and that's the last election. That's certainly Iran runs sham elections, but the Islamists are not going to get tossed out of power in that dictatorship. Can Ennahda lose in Tunisia? We'll stay tuned for the next 2 years.
Now, of course, the thing that's been in the news this week has been Libya and what's going to happen with them. I know the mainstream media has touted it as, well, you know, with Gaddafi dead, it's over and like that. But it doesn't seem that way to me. What do you think, Jim?
Well, as we reported, I think, just in the last few days, indeed, what we should do in the next update is lay out a scorecard, as it were, the tribes and ethnic groups of Libya. There are many. I mean, the basic problem with Libya was that until it was created after World War II, it was always, for thousands of years, three different provinces. Sometimes independent, usually briefly independent, but belonging either to Egypt or Turkey or you name it, Rome, and so on, Italy. Gaddafi never really united it. He basically tried to buy everybody off, you know, buy peace, and then he had his main hobby was, often lethal, you know, foreign policy intrigues. We think of Lockerbie and like that and the various terrorist, operations he backed, but most of his activity was directed at his neighbors and especially south into Black Africa, where he is fondly or foully, you know, remembered, depending upon which end of his machinations you were on. That's all gone now, of course. In fact, Gaddafi several years ago, after 9/11, he took the pledge, I'm not going to, terrorist war no more. But he basically had to confront the damage he had done to Libya over the four decades he was in power. And so now Libya is right back to where it was. People have four decades of bitter, repression, to dwell upon, but they still have their tribal and regional and ethnic differences. And it's going to be interesting to see how this all works out. On top of that, you have the fact that since there's no practical experience in democratic government in Libya, the only people who are organized, and this goes back to the Bolsheviks, in the Russian Revolution, the only organized people are the Islamic radicals, who are all trying to, update their playbook, saying, let's do it right this time and take over. But everybody's wary of them. The internet, we can thank the internet for that. There's all sorts of chatter, I'm being told by my Arab-speaking contacts, that there's all sorts of, wild discussions going on about, who's on first in Libya. And it really, I think as we pointed out during the last update, it's going to take a while to shake out. Nobody's sure, who is willing to die. Or how far any group is willing to go to try and grab the power, or there's just going to be a civil war and Libya is going to fall apart into probably not three, probably two, because there are two main groupings of oil wells, oil fields, you know, one in the east and one in the west, out in the desert. And the problem with the desert is there's not many people down there. That's only, I think, 10% of the population. So, you know, although the desert peoples, the Tuaregs and what have you, various desert nomadic tribes, might make a claim to the UN or whatever, you know, any news organization that it's theirs, they haven't got the people, they haven't got the guns. So it's basically going to be Tripoli and, you know, nation, area, proto-nations, centered around Tripoli and Benghazi. There's a possibility Egypt might get involved. Egypt has always believed that Eastern, you know, Libya really belongs to them. Now you don't hear about that much in the West because it just never caught on. But in the Arab world, it's, especially in Egypt, it's always been an active topic. I remember, you know, back in the 70s, I got a visit from this deputy chief of staff of the Egyptian army who wanted some help on war games, which I was in the business of at that time. And, their main interest was Libya. And that hasn't changed. It was going on long before the, you know, general, whatever his name was, Nasser so-and-so, showed up at my door, and it's still going on. So the big problem with Libya, there is no clear, you know, path, for, you know, the future to stroll down, which makes it interesting because nobody knows what's going to happen.
All right. It seems like there's probably going to be some low-level guerrilla warfare for some time there.
There already is. There are, at last count, over 100 militias. Basically, every neighborhood, every, you know, small area, basically formed a militia, which might have been only a few dozen guys, sometimes less, around a local leader, and went off to war. And these are in loose coalitions. In Tripoli, there's supposed to be, last count, there's close to 170, I think was the count, 74. There are still many in Benghazi, and of course there were a lot of them, or portions of them, you know, down in Sirte and several other interior areas which were more pro-Gaddafi. A lot of looting going on, that's what drew a lot of these guys. I mean, these guys are basically, some of them are in uniforms, but they're all basically civilians. They were very, Gaddafi never built that much of an army. He brought a lot of equipment, but he never really trusted, you know, trained troops, you know, in Libya. And most of the real power in Libya was the various secret police organizations, which he closely controlled, which is fairly typical in most Arab countries. That's what's going on in Syria. Most of the heavy lifting is being done by the secret police because they can't trust the army. So in Libya, all of the various factions are on an equal footing as far as, you know, military power goes, because NATO destroyed most of the heavy weapons, which is probably a good thing in the long run. And the Libyans have allowed American and NATO teams in to basically secure and in some cases destroy some of the weapons dumps. Now, the Libyans are allowing the destruction of some of those weapons dumps, A, because a lot of the weapons are old and basically been sitting out in the desert for decades, but secondly, because even there, some expert Libyans, chemists and what have you, recognize that a lot of the, you know, decades old ammunition Gaddafi had stored out there is unstable, and it's just a mess. And so they're more than happy to let the, you know, the Europeans and Americans, these are, the Americans at least, are former military, they're civilian contractors technically, but they're EOD people, explosives ordnance disposal. They're basically out there getting rid of this stuff. And as a bonus, the Libyans are letting them collect all the shoulder, you know, fired surface-to-air missiles they can find. Many of those are crossing the border. They're showing up. The Israelis are getting apoplectic because they're hearing from Egyptian contacts that the stuff is showing up on the black market, you know, Syrian weapons in general, but especially the missiles, which the smugglers believe would bring the highest prices. Again, some of these missiles are very old. Somebody told me the realistic shelf life of a Russian, you know, shoulder-fired SAM is like 5 years. Anything older than 5 years, you know, you might as well, you know, cross your fingers when you fire it, because chances are it's not going to, one component or another is going to, not function, and that's going to, you know, ruin the entire, you know, operation. So the missiles actually, I mean, a lot of people in effect, believe that the missiles are more of a media event than they are a military event. But the Israelis can't take any chances, because if you're an Israeli helicopter pilot and you happen to be in the sights of one of the missiles that does work, you know, you're in big trouble. You're not absolutely dead, because the Israeli helicopters and aircraft have systems to defeat missiles like that. But nothing is 100%. So the Israelis have never lost a helicopter over Gaza, and nobody wants to be the first one. But with all these missiles out there, that obviously increases the probability of some poor, Shlomo, being the first, gunship pilot, Israeli helicopter pilot to be taken down over Gaza. But aside from that, yes, in Libya, you've got all these militias, and we're talking about nationwide gang war.
Austin, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I'm going to take it from a different tack. Jim's gone through all the factional problems, fractiousness, and Libya, in some ways, may have a good chance. Well, let me tell you why I think so. They've actually got something worth selling. Oil could divide them. Well, it could also unite them. One of the common complaints among the Libyans was, we're getting cheated by they would say the Gaddafi's elites, Gaddafi favoring his own Gaddafi tribe and some of their associated clans, and also what they would say the old wealthy trading merchants of Tripoli. There's a possibility that the oil, depends on what we see over the next 6 to 8 months on how this national government evolves. If it falls apart like Jim thinks it could, probably will, then just forget what I'm saying. We've got a mess in our hands. But again, I'm giving you an alternative scenario, which is one which has some possibility of occurring. The Libyan National Council has asked that NATO remain involved diplomatically and politically. They're seeking, in other words, external actors to act as provide structure to their process of building a new government. And if you get an honest break for all tribes, all areas, all sectors of Libya from the oil revenues, you could see the country hang together. What would that look like? It might be like the kind of ultimately revenue sharing pool that Alaska's got, or the Iraqis talk about having, where everybody sees a return from the sale of oil. You get your own personal check. So these are things that I'm not making these up. These are things that I've seen that Libyans have been discussing. Will they be turned into policy? I don't know. But if you do follow that path, there's a reason, economic reason, mutual interest reason, for Libya to hang together.
Hmm. Well, Austin, let's start with you on sort of wrapping this up with Syria. Where are we at there?
I'll tell you what. I'll refer to that piece I wrote about 3 weeks ago, which was basically saying that we're watching NATO versus Iran fighting a war in Syria. Syrian fragmentation, that is the fear that Turkey and Turkey being the lead NATO nation in Syria, heck, it's right on Turkey's border. That's a fear. We get fragmentation into all of the kaleidoscope of religious and ethnic groups that inhabit Syria. I mean, it's like it's a big Lebanon. Well, Lebanon and Syria used to be the province of Syria during the Ottoman Empire, and you had a little bit of everything, multiple Christian sects, multiple Muslim sects, predominantly Sunni, but then various Shia and even some questionable Shia sects. What are the Alawites, which are the what the Assad clan is? They get lumped with Shias. Some Shia say they really aren't Muslims like us. They're more like, as Jim often says when we bring up the Druze, the other Muslims say, well, the Druze really aren't Muslims, they're heretics. And there are significant Druze tribes in Syria, Lebanon, and even within within Israel. So you've got this, you've got the potential for a shattered kaleidoscope as a way to describe it. Now, curiously enough, Iran doesn't want to see Syria fragment either. The Assad regime has been their most reliable client. The Assad's act as a way to pass weapons and money to Hezbollah in Lebanon, to Hamas in Gaza. I mean, and they are essentially Iranian-financed proxy forces for waging a war with Israel, but also upsetting the rest of the, you know, the, it's a way to wage war by the Iranians with Egypt. Upsetting the balance. They don't want destabilize, get the entire region destabilized, which the Iranian dictatorship sees as in its interest. So they don't want to see it fragment either, but for a completely different reason. Now, how is it going to turn out? The discussions began, I noticed in, I want to say late May, early June, so probably discussions predate that. But you could, I read a couple of reports, actually, I think one of them through the English language, Turkish press, of Syrian dissident groups saying, we need to form an umbrella organization. And as I noted in the column that ran about 3 weeks ago, an umbrella organization was formed by the end of the summer. It's now had two or three different names. One I saw calling it the Syrian National Council, sounding almost like the Libyan National Council, but the SNC, there was another name I saw somebody had applied to it, and it is just as, it is more disparate and faction-ridden than Libya, the way Jim just described Libya a moment ago. But they have produced a manifesto that says they want to see a secular government, a secular democratic government established in Syria. Yes, the Sunni Muslims are the largest component of it, but they're not calling for a dictatorship run by the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood. They're not calling for that. They've got Kurdish groups, and remember, the northeastern triangle of Syria is Kurdish, is a Kurdish region. The Kurds, Syrian Kurds, are involved in this as well. And what they're asking for is outside support from other Arab nations, already looking towards Tunisia and Libya, and NATO, Europe, and the United States. Now, there was an interesting article earlier this week in the Wall Street Journal by Amir Tahiri talking just about, he was writing about this Syrian umbrella organization and what they want. Could read it and say that's utter pie in the sky. They're not going to pull it off. But the thing is that the Syrians point out, and Tahiri pointed this out in his article, he said, look, the Syrian government has been trying for 5 months to stop this rebellion, and the rebellion is going on all over the country. Just to go back to what I wrote, I said that there are just too many little fires going on all the time, and they just can't put them out. It's, are we going to hang together to get rid of the Assads, or are the Assads going to come by and to destroy us individually? Well, we've showed on the battlefield, in the battlefield, their neighborhoods, or the battlefield, that we got the guts to stick it out, and they can't defeat us if we just continue the resistance. We need outside help, because the Syrian government, the Assad regime, gets the help of Iran. Will you, as NATO, will you, Turkey, will you, other Arab nations, help us stop the Iranians? So here's the wild card on this, Dan, as I've laid it out. Obviously, I don't know how this is going to play out, but one of the more feudal countries on this planet is Saudi Arabia, but they are the enemy of Iran. They say Iran is there correctly as the big threat to Saudi Arabia. Here's the feudal tribal government of Saudi Arabia interested in seeing Syria topple the Assads because that damages Iran. Is that going to play out? Just a wild card to consider anyway.
Jim?
I agree that Saudi Arabia is playing an odd role in this because they themselves are under attack because they're a monarchy, as are the other Arab Gulf states. But I think the big difference here, and this is probably going to be noted by any surviving dictators, is that the Saudis have been very good to the Saudi people, perhaps too good. I mean, they've created an ultimate welfare state where you really don't have to work at all. You can get a do-nothing government job. And basically anybody who becomes a problem gets bought off. They don't fill up prison camps. They believe in re-education, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this sounds utterly ridiculous, but when you consider how much oil they have and how few people they have, I mean, most of the population of Saudi Arabia are foreigners imported to do the work nobody else wants to do. I'm not just talking about picking up the garbage. I'm talking about, running a retail store or, even a lot of supervisory, white-collar type work. Saudis just don't want to be bothered. Most of the students in Saudi universities are studying religion, not engineering or business or what have you. So that's not really a sustainable model in the long term, but if you simply want enough peace until you die in bed, that's the way to go if you can afford it. Gaddafi tried to do this, but he got sloppy, and that's where he became a cropper. He started believing his own press releases, which is always a big and usually fatal mistake. But when you look at the economics of Libya, people were doing quite well. They simply weren't happy. So if you can't turn all that that generosity into happiness, you're doing something wrong. And this is something that the Gulf oil states, even some of these smaller Gulf states that haven't got a lot of oil, they hustle, they use fewer foreigners and they make money and they make sure they keep everybody happy. Now, Bahrain has a problem because most of the Bahrainis are Shia, and for various historic and other reasons, they're not the economic powerhouses in the country. They should be, but because of past discrimination and what have you, they are mostly uneducated and unmotivated, or especially compared to the Sunni minority. But even Bahrain has been able to keep, the lid on it with a combination of, carrots and sticks. So the takeaway is going to be the Saudi model, which this really sounds terrible, what Saudi Arabia is. But that's what works. And the democracies in the Arab world are going to have an uphill climb because they have no model except Iraq, which nobody wants to touch because the Americans, foreigners, were, brought that about. Got to invent everything as they go along. And, the Arab world has not been, for the last few centuries, a place where a lot of new stuff gets invented and accepted.
Right. Well, that's a good place to wrap up. We've used up our time. Very interesting discussion. We appreciate it, and we'll talk to you gentlemen next time.
Bye. Till next time. Bye. Bye-bye.